Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know
we're gonna have a Solartopia?
Started to burn too many things we found. Back in Solartopia here, we don't burn anything we find in the ground. We leave it there, we treasure it, and we get our power from the sun and the wind and the tides and the oceans and all that good stuff. We are back for another hour of Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, and we understand that in Solartopia there will be hand-counted paper ballots, and we will never, ever, ever wind up in the White House with a lunatic. Not that we have one now, but it's something to be discussed. And I want to put out there at the beginning of the show, we have three great people are working on this election integrity issue on the show today. That Hillary Clinton's book is the book about Hillary Clinton's campaign is coming out. And I just want to put out there that if the United States of America had hand-counted paper ballots and universal automatic voter registration with transparent voter rolls in 2016, Donald Trump would not be president of the United States, no way, shape, or form. So we're going to discuss that. We've had an important couple of congressional elections, special elections, one in Kansas, and then a runoff. We're going to have a runoff in Georgia. Once again, I believe that the electronic voting machines and the electronic manipulation of the registration rolls has been the decisive factor in both these elections. And we have an election, another special election coming up in Montana. And that one, I think we might actually have a chance. So we're going to talk with John Simon. John, you on with us?
Yep. Hey, Harvey.
How are you doing, John? Mimi Kennedy, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi. Hi, John. Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Mimi. Hi, Mimi. And John Brakey, have you called in? Okay, John Brakey has not yet called in. I hope I sufficiently told him that we wanted him on the call. But so let's start with this. We got the full hour to talk about it. It's very important. I was really angry after the Georgia election, the special congressional election, because nobody mentioned the fact that election fraud might well have been involved. And I personally, I've been asked not to write this, but I don't give the Democrats much chance of winning the seat as long as there are electronic voting machines involved. Mimi Kennedy, we'll start with you and then talk to John. Can you introduce yourself? Tell us how great you are and what an incredibly beautiful, fantastic Hollywood actress you are, as well as just one of the most amazing activists I've ever known. Or is that a sufficient introduction?
For an hour, Harvey. I have been an actress since I graduated from Smith College in 1970, and I've done film and stage and TV, and right now I'm playing a 12-step counselor on Mom. However, since the election of 2000, I've been aware that of election stealing in a way that I never was before, although I heard all the jokes about Chicago, the dead vote, and my own father, who was a precinct walker in Rochester, New York, for the Republican Party, because his stepfather was a Republican judge who had been very good to four little children who had been left fatherless by an early death. He used to talk about very thin margins back with those lever voting machines that you used to pull the curtain. At any rate, 2004, the John Kerry, I was making phone calls all day and hearing how wonderful the exit polls were. Kerry was going to win, and then he didn't. And by 2006, I was involved in getting a Secretary of State elected for California that had promised to review all of this software, including many Diebold counties that we had, and ESNS ones, such as L.A., and she would kick out anything that wasn't verifiable and secure. So California returned to a paper ballot pretty much everywhere, and we elected Jerry Brown, and we're a progressive state, and those two things are connected. So Progressive Democrats of America formed in 2004 because we were disappointed John Kerry was not going to talk about the Iraq War. And then when the election was stolen from him, as we saw it, we added election integrity to a founding principle of Progressive Democrats of America, and we waded into that when other groups considered the topic taboo, like Move On and some of the more prominent ones at that time, Democracy for America. We were the only ones who really spoke up. So by force of necessity, I've learned to be something of an expert on the voting systems used throughout the United States. John Brakey, John Simon, who's on with us. I mean, all of these people I've appeared on panels with, and I've tried to wake up the Democratic Party through its progressive wing to the desperate need for verifiable paper ballot-based elections. And we're kind of getting somewhere, but still no leaders will come out and speak about it openly, as evidenced by the fact that Hillary Clinton was mum all during that time, and Donald Trump was the one going, it's going to be rigged, it's going to be rigged. And we were like, oh, no, we don't want the insane man, the racist, to take up our cause. On the other hand, we couldn't get the Democrats to talk about it. So it's been a depressing political point, but it's been an exciting civic issue to be
accurate on. Well, what some of us realized, John Simon, I'm sure did, Mimi, you and I, that Trump was actually telling the truth when he said that the election was rigged, but he was the one rigging it. The people for him.
It was a great
strategy to do that. John Simon, come on, introduce yourself and say a few words, and then we're going to get to specifics about these three congressional elections.
Yes. Hi, Harvey. Well, like Mimi, I was kind of pressed into service. This was not my first calling in life, but it's come to dominate my life over the last 15 or 16 years since 2000, 2001. And, you know, I keep looking at the big picture. I mean, you had a great show last week with Bev Harris and Don Goldmacher, and you guys focused on the Georgia election. And, you know, the only thing that struck me about that is that we do it over and over again, like, you know, Charlie Brown coming up to kick the football, that, you know, we follow after the election circus with our forensic pooper scooper and try to prove that this, that, or the other election was rigged, and nobody wants to hear it. And when you step back and just look at the big picture and the whole pattern of elections, one after another, you know, throughout this computerized voting era, it just becomes unmistakable. It's like stepping back a couple of feet from a Puntillist painting, and picture a Puntillist painting of Munch's The Scream. And all of a sudden it comes into view and you realize, well, this just could not happen. Disparity between the public will as measured in every other way, polls, opinion surveys, just the eye test, versus the electoral results. And you see it happening in election after election, where there's red flag after red flag, where the elections are competitive and therefore can be rigged and still pass the smell test. And your, you know, and the elections that have national significance, which extend all the way down to things like Secretary of State, Attorney General, and states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, and state legislatures in these states. So it's not just the presidency; it's a big swath of elections that, if you want to control America, you take control of this political infrastructure, and we've seen that happen. With patterns that keep repeating, essentially what we saw a few weeks ago in Georgia, what we saw in Ohio in 2004, which is strategic, targeted, suspect elections. Very hard to prove they're rigged because we're denied all hard evidence. Memory cards, machines, code, you name it, is off limits. So we look at patterns and numerical patterns and statistical patterns that are, you know, over and over, very unlikely and very suspect to, you know, a rational analysis. But the forces of denial are so great that that analysis tends to be ignored or even at times scoffed at. It's brought me around to a place, even though my roots in this are doing election forensics, and I was the bloke who downloaded the exit polls in 2004 and sort of, you know, in many ways kicked off this whole approach to things. It's brought me around to a place where I'm less interested in trying to beat my head against that wall and prove that elections have been stolen. I believe if you gave me 10 minutes, hypothetically, thought experiment, 10 minutes in a room with each of, let's say, 100 million American voters, we'll leave the non-voters out of it, presumably they don't care enough to vote, but people who have voted on either side, blue or red, and I could sit down individually for 5 minutes even, certainly 10 minutes, alone in a room, and just talk about the stakes of these elections that are upcoming, as well as the elections that we've just had, but certainly the ones in 2018, 2020, the stakes and the risk of corruption. I believe I could get, you know, 80 or 90% of them on board to say we demand public observable vote counting, just like the Dutch just implemented in their election, and we're not going to trust these computers to determine the fate of this country and the fate of this planet. And that would be voters on both sides of the political divide, I think, would be very, very easy to bring around. And the real problem becomes communication outreach. Without the media as a megaphone, with the media absolutely refusing to touch this, how do you get to those voters, and how do you mobilize them to make this demand upon the office holders? Because the office holders, they've been elected. Their incentive to change the system is zero or negative, especially if they're in the majority. So what is it that will provide enough pressure that they will be forced to introduce legislation to change this system? And that's, I think, where we're at. We have to look at what we do about the situation we're in now, more so than proving that we're in it.
Well, that's a pretty good stretch of talk there, John. Very, very comprehensive and impressive. John Brakey, have you joined us? John Brakey has not. So, with that great background from two of the top experts in the United States, I have co-written. John, you didn't talk about your book. Tell us about your book real quick.
Yes. Well, you know, along the lines, I've written quite a few articles and blogged on this, but I decided that, you know, one vehicle that would be very helpful would be a place where people could look up, look at the whole thing at once and look at the history and look at the mechanisms and look at what we, you know, need to do about it. So I wrote a book in 2014 called Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century. And it's been available on Amazon. It's had two new editions, including just before the 2016 election. And I'm working on a 2016 election edition, and I'm in negotiations with a publisher for that.
Well, good for you. And I want to, since you mentioned self-publishing, Bob Patrakis and I are about to come out with either our sixth or seventh book. I can't remember what it is, which is a comprehensive overview of election theft throughout United States history. The field does keep changing. I won't say the goalposts are moving, but we are going to put it out there. And I do have a request. Anybody, I have developed a new hat for everybody. It's the new American hat. It's going to be, it says, it's purple to honor both Democrats and Republicans. And it's on it, embroidered. It's an American made and union embroidered hat. And it says Restore Sanity. So if anybody wants to email me and tell me how I can put this online, I'd appreciate it. I'm completely helpless in front of the computer. Mimi, you've written a bunch of stuff. You don't have a book yet, do you? But you
No, the only book I have is a midlife memoir, and I'm working on fiction. But no, I don't have a book, but I do intend soon to be able to trace the history of my activism, and that will have a large dollop of election integrity discussion, although recreating that history is it's really hard because chronologically the traveling that I've done for PDA and the various things, but I remember the outstanding stuff. It'll just take quite a bit of research too if I have to get specific and footnote it, put it down. I'm sure as a historian, Harvey, you know that.
Absolutely, I do know that. And but your work has been great, and you you wrote us an introduction, which I'm asking you to upgrade now because we're going to put this comprehensive book. I have to say, we're going to put it out. I'm just waiting for Bob to do some revisions. I have to say, you know, this is my 44th year fighting nuclear power, and I have written God knows how much stuff about nuclear power, and I have to say, you know, I've written, you know, dozens of articles about children dying and animals dying. And I went to Three Mile Island the year after the accident. Nothing is more infuriating than writing about election theft.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just something about it that gets under your skin. And, you know, when I wrote when after 2004, we did a catalog of all the different things that they did, the way they stole the election in 2004. And I literally had to get up and throw stuff. You know,
yes.
After I write, you know, they did this, they did that, and I just, you know, want to break windows. And I mean, it's just so infuriating to see,
you know,
our democracy stolen.
You share that with Bev Harris. She has said to me that her current focus is on corruption of county officials because she's seen it so many places. And she's, for a long time, it's people call her to whistleblow because they know she's an election integrity researcher. But what she finds when she goes and sees facts on the ground are just obfuscation, cover up. And she goes, well, no wonder this is happening because there's a history of corruption with impunity among often county officials because it's often county officials who make land use decisions and utility use decisions. So they're very often the ones that any special interest would be most interested in controlling. And so it's part of the culture. So when we realize that all our election systems are basically county run, county operated, county overseen, it became in Chicago a joke about the counties that let the dead vote. But now you combine it with computerized election theft and it became normalized. So she's trying to go into talking about the history of local corruption because then we remove that layer of denial, which we as election integrity, what, writers, teachers, often get, which is no, nobody would do that. Democracy is sacred, and you're imputing terrible evils to our elected officials. Why would you do that? That's unpatriotic, et cetera. And
yeah. Well, can I jump in for a second on that? I mean,
yes,
you know, I think we're all infuriated. I mean, I feel the same way about writing. It's something I even wrote in my book. This is not a fun book to write. I don't want to write it. You know, that may sound like a high maintenance person's complaint, but believe me, I mean, this has taken a big chunk out of my life.
Yeah.
And my psyche. And I think the reason is, you know, we're stuck in a very small closet with a very big lie. And
yes,
we are just stuck in there smelling this rotten lie. We are the beacon of democracy. America's great. This could never happen here. And you have a crime that can be committed by a very, very small cadre of people. I mean, literally, you know, just literally a roomful of people is all it takes. I mean, given the computers, and this has been established, you know, in research by institutions like Princeton and the Brennan Center. It really takes one person to rig a whole slew of elections. But you have this enormous, enormous crew of enablers,
yes,
stretching from these officials, these election officials, all the way up to the New York Times or The Nation or The New Yorker.
Yep.
I mean, people who goddamn well should know better. And, you know, presumably put out a very good product and have the, at least in part of their minds and their hearts, the well-being of the world is part of their agenda. And yet, will not look at this, will scoff at anybody who attempts to look at it, dismiss them, all of us, you know, as conspiracy theorists, tell us that we've brought them no evidence when we have brought them copious evidence. You know, the question then becomes, what's the probative value of that evidence? But I've been told personally, you have brought us no evidence. We don't deal in speculation.
Yeah.
And these are the enablers, and these are the institutions of our country that we'd otherwise, you know, rely on and be proud of. And, you know, to be sort of you know, fighting that battle and be so puny in so many ways. And, you know, Harvey, you said your computers give you the willies. That's true for me, too. And a lot of us, we don't know how to communicate in this information age. So we have a vital, vital, vital message and are kind of crippled when it comes to getting it out and getting it to the public. And that, after a while, becomes very corrosive. And so we, I think, all share that sense of being infuriated. And there's a lot of burnout in this field because there's only so much a person can take.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know,
go ahead,
there, we have a culture of obedience as well, and this innocent until proven guilty, which is a sacred tenet of our justice system, has been twisted so that even to include in an election story, for instance, this has been my ask, just include the voting system that was used. Just mention in your reporting that these are the counties that were involved in the district, and these are the voting systems that predominate. And that is reporting. But they would say, at this point, special interests would go, why would you include that? Are you implying? Are you implying something that's libelous, to even imply that there would be anything wrong with our corporation's voting system, is to lessen our stockholders' shares, and so we're going to sue you. That's an implication of guilt, and we will have none of it. And our media is cowed by that. That's the part that's beginning to upset me, is this room, as you speak of it, John, is getting smaller and smaller because normal reporting has suddenly become libelous reporting. These thin-skinned corporations that don't even want to be mentioned in a story, or donors who don't even want to be mentioned as having supported a cause or a referendum. I mean, we're all now supposed to be as anonymous in our money, in our voting systems, as the anonymous ballot is. It's like this whole thing is leaked out. Private ballot. Oh, well, also private anything else having to do with elections. Otherwise, what are you implying? I'm finding that there's a culture of belief there that we are up against, and I'm trying to find ways to separate it out and go, no, the ballot is private. Everything else should be transparent. Otherwise, what are they hiding? When we come to have our voices, that's an anonymous sump of votes. That's why we have to be so careful about everything else. But the media won't even report the voting system or whether there's paper ballots or how the people vote in terms of paper, not paper, electronic, anything.
Absolutely right. You know, there's the great quote, which I use almost all the time when I talk about this, from the movie A Few Good Men with Jack Nicholson. And he's on the stand there, and he's been involved in a murder. And Tom Cruise is cross-examining him, and he says, just tell us the truth. And Jack Nicholson says, truth? You can't handle the truth. I mean,
yeah,
people can't handle the idea,
yeah,
that the whole system is completely rotten. And most of all, the people who can't handle it most of all are the Democrats, for God's sake. I mean, I got to tell you, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the Democratic Party has won every presidential election in this country since 1992. I mean, Bill Clinton was probably legitimately elected in 2000, in 92 and 96. In 2000, Al Gore was the rightful winner. In 2004, John Kerry was the rightful winner. In 2008 and 2012,
Obama
was the rightful winner. And in 2016, Hillary Clinton was the rightful winner. And look what we've got. You know, we had 8 years of the lunatic George W. Bush, and now we have this psychopath in the White House, and none of these guys were elected. And we have three successful Democratic candidates for president, all the multi-millionaires, of course, Gore, Kerry, and Hillary Clinton. And not one of them has said a word about any of these elections. It's infuriating.
It is infuriating, but I think as long as they keep their jobs, this is what I've deduced now. It's kind of like an actor, you know. Well, we're going to fire half the cast of your show. Well, as long as I keep my job, it's okay by me. And I get the feeling that that's what's going on with the Democrats, and they keep burdening the people with more voters, more money, more. The media is not covering us, but we'll get it if you'll do it. You do the coverage. You do everything. And then when they're defeated by a small function in a computer, they pretend like, oh, we almost made it, instead of going, shit, let's look at that computer. That is infuriating, and I don't know if it's because the donors are basically eeny, meeny, miny, mo, this time a Democrat, this time a Republican. We don't care. We're going to just lobby for what we want in whatever power structure there is. And damn,
well,
sometimes those Democrats are scary.
So in light of that, I'm sorry, Harvey, I didn't mean to.
Well, here, let me just say one thing, John, and then and you take it.
Yeah.
I think the Democrats are actually more comfortable being out of office. I think having Donald Trump in the White House is something most of the regular corporate Democrats love, because they don't have to do anything. All they have to do is not be Donald Trump. And then they can write these. I get, you know, 10 fundraising emails a day, three from Nancy Pelosi, and all saying, oh, my God, Trump's going to destroy the world. Send us money. Well, what are you guys going to do? They don't do anything. The Democrats don't do anything. And so it's easier for them just to be not have to take any responsibility. You know, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and Al Gore are worth, I think Hillary is the poorest of the three, worth probably about $100 million. Kerry, you know, many hundreds. Gore, I think, is probably a billionaire. And what do they care? Their job is just to be rich people. And, you know, they run for president, they run for office, all these guys. They lose, you know, which we know what happens. I mean, we all know what happens. It's a close election. They're ahead in the early evening. Suddenly there's a glitch in the computer. And, you know, they fix the computer and suddenly they lose. It happened again in Georgia this last night.
Yep.
You know, it's just so obvious. And they won't say anything.
Yeah, and you're leaving out Obama and his multi-$100 million book deal. I mean, all these guys are fat and happy. You know, what I would like to do, though, is I'd just like to turn things. I mean, God knows the criticism is justified, and I subscribe completely to what you're saying. Where do we get the power? You know, the parties, we can complain about it, and we can petition, and we can parade, and we can protest, and all that. But, you know, where do we actually get the power to restore our sovereignty? And that's where, you know, I look at the Dutch, and the Dutch took one whiff of our 2016 elections, including the primary, and they took one weekend to decide and basically said, we're going to count our national election by hand. And surprise, surprise, the far-right candidate fell on his flat on his face, and the Greens got four times as many seats as they have in any previous election.
Exactly.
Is there a linkage there? Is there a correlation? Who knows? But they decided to count that election by hand just like that. Now, it's not rocket science. It's not even putting a man on the moon. It's not solving climate change. It's not bringing about world peace and disarmament. It's counting a few goddamn votes. And it's a very easy technical fix to go to hand-counted paper ballots, even in a country like the U.S. that has a longer ballot. But if you don't want to go to hand-counted paper ballots, you go to election night, risk-limiting audits, public, observable, et cetera. They're pretty simple ways here. They're not particularly difficult. They're not expensive. this is something that could be done just like the Dutch did it, only we're not there. And the question is, you know, how do we get there? How do we make this fundamental, absolute core level, you know, foundational change upon which so many other changes would then follow?
Yeah.
And, you know, the more I've thought about this, the more I feel we live in a capitalist age. Corporations look at the bottom line, and they see 0.1% this way or that way, and it makes all the difference in the world. And we've seen what's happened with United Airlines. We've seen what's happened in the state of North Carolina. We've seen what's happened with boycotts. The real power in this culture lies with consumers.
Yep.
Workers and taxpayers, but above all, consumers. We're the ones who have the duty. Our duty is not to democracy. Our duty is to capitalism, and our duty is to keep buying stuff.
Yep.
If we said, if we could get people together and we had the capacity to outreach and convince them of the critical nexus between this cause and climate change, economic justice, peace, all the things which are now going rapidly down the toilet. And we said, look, you have the power. You can see it. Just say, take the people of Wisconsin. We're not buying a single goddamn thing that we don't need outside of milk and cookies and eggs. We're not buying any flat-screen TVs. We're not buying any the latest new cell phone. We're not buying racks and racks of clothing. We're not buying that new car. We're not buying anything we don't need until you pass legislation to have the votes counted observably in public. End of story. And you stuck to that. They'd be on their knees in weeks. The corporations would come to their servants in the state house and say, you got to do this. You got to pass this law. Our bottom lines are tanking. This is really where our power is. And we need somebody who can articulate that. We need many people who can get that message out. I'm thinking of influencers. I'm thinking of Mark Cuban. I'm thinking of some celebrities out there. I'm thinking of people who have megaphones. You could sit down with them. And you could get this message out, and they could start mobilizing these people. Look how quickly the people got together to boycott Amazon for all things, carrying Ivanka Trump's perfume. I mean, you know, great, but rather trivial in relatively speaking. Now, if we could make that same outreach and bring them together to exercise their collective economic power in this cause, we would get that legislation. And you know what? I don't think there's any other way that we get that legislation, because why should these politicians be responsive to anybody other than their corporate masters? We can't vote them out of office. And there's the rub. It's a catch-22. With the current voting system, they know, if nothing else intuitively, that we can't vote them out of office. In 2014, the Republican Congress, majority Congress, had an approval rating of 8% that is below the Hitler line. And they had 222 incumbent U.S. House members, of whom 220 were reelected. They're not afraid of protests. They're not afraid of petitions. They're not afraid of lobbying, you know, in the name of democracy. They know what the results are. So it has to be public insistence backed by muscle. And the muscle is the economic muscle of saying, we're not going to be good little consumers or good little workers or good little taxpayers. But the only one that they can't really penalize or punish is consumers. You know, you don't pay your taxes, you might go to jail. You don't work, you might get fired. But you don't buy, and it's their problem. And that's,
we
need to,
you know, John, this is Mimi. I'm not sure that they can't punish consumers, and I would just point out geography, which pertains ultimately to the ballot box, which I think that the solution is to think less nationally, both in terms of percentages. Boy, I remember that thing you're invoking. It's such a low approval rate for Congress, and yet somehow those Republicans all got elected again. Why? Because they got elected in much smaller population distributions then gave us the 8% approval rating. So we're confused by the stories we're being told, and frankly, it's a shell game. We are distracted. The real power does have, ultimately, of the ballot box is jurisdictional. And I would just say that I have seen communities of color punished for being whatever they are, you know, not rebellious, you know, whatever. So you're going to have all liquor stores, and you're not going to have a nice grocery store. No corporate grocery store wants to put their nice grocery store in your neighborhood because we don't like you. And that's that. That's how we're deciding. I am just saying that both our government under Trump, it's very obvious, and corporations don't give a flying damn, to put it more politely than it really should be put, about people who are saying, I am voluntarily going on a hunger strike or in prison, say, or I am voluntarily giving something. They're like, good. We don't care. Die. Die. We don't care.
Maybe that's true for you or me individually, but you get enough people together to actually get behind that and sign it,
right,
and it starts moving the needle on their bottom line, and then they start caring in a hurry, and I think we've seen that. I mean, we saw it with United Airlines. I mean, you know, they
not
did something, obviously, you know, poster boy reprehensible, and immediately, you know, you just had this huge reaction. So things can go from, you know, puny to critical mass with, if you hit the right meme and you get the right people who know how to, you know, work social media, which unfortunately we don't seem to be very good at, but, you know, things can move very quickly and you get people. I mean, right now, look, let's face it, there is an enormous energy of resistance. I mean, I know there are Trump voters out there somewhere and they're ostensibly some millions of them, but there are also millions and clearly a majority of people who are either were against him to begin with or are now having serious second thoughts when confronted with his depravity and, you know, and recognizing that he's not doing anything that's going to help them. I mean, it will dawn on at least some of them. So you have just this huge, huge proportion of the population that is, you know, riled up. They came and put on pink hats and went to a protest. I mean, if you take just even the people who went to protest that day and they signed on and stopped doing their good little consumer duty, they would suffer in the sense that they wouldn't have that new flat screen TV or whatever it is. And, you know, and this even goes down, you know, you could say, well, this is a protest among people who have economic choices. But, you know, frankly, even people at the relatively low on the socioeconomic ladder do buy a lot of inessentials in this country. So it could be something that everybody in one way or another could participate in. And I do think that, you know, it has a pretty direct and rapid effect on corporations. They see their sales go down. They link it with the fact that they're being targeted and boycotted. And they want, you know, a public legislative action. Okay, what do the people want? Oh, they want observable vote count? Yeah, all right. Let's go for that. So, you know, you get this kind of translation of public power. I mean, populism can be obviously rather dangerous in the hands of a demagogue, but after all,
what we're after here is something very, very simple,
basic, and justifiable.
All right, John, let me jump in. First of all, a couple things. First of all, obviously, we need Yogi Berra back, because as he put it, you know, if people don't want to come to the ballpark, you can't stop them. So that's our byword. We're talking here, by the way, with Mimi Kennedy, great activist and wonderful friend from Los Angeles, and John Simon. You're somewhere up the coast in California now, author of Code Red and a longtime ballot and election integrity activist. So there's a couple of things on the table I want to talk about. First of all, the idea of a boycott or exercising our economic power is a great one. Now, when Gandhi wanted the British out of India, he chose salt. And, you know, salt was an important commodity. People actually laughed at him and scoffed at him when he decided that he was going to focus on salt. But it worked. And we need to think of a single commodity that we could actually stage a national boycott that would hurt the corporate structure and get their attention. I think the demand for hand counted paper ballots is a great one, because what was that?
I have no idea.
Well, I was actually seconding the idea of the focus
exactly.
on
the agreement with you.
Hand counted paper ballot. I think if we keep it simple and obvious, we don't have to put forward the what we know to be true of what other people consider conspiracy theory on the electronic voting machines. By the way, just for the record, Bob Fitrakis and I have been blacklisted by Daily Kos, you know, this mouthpiece of the Democratic Party, for even suggesting that it might have been a problem that Mitt Romney had an economic interest in the voting machines in Cincinnati, that we're going to count that election. They threw us off, Daily Kos, for that. They've never posted anything else I've written, even though most of my stuff that I posted there was about nuclear power. You also mentioned populism. I just put out a piece which is a truth dig, and this is important, that the word populist is a leftist word. It came from the Populist Party, the farmers in the United States, who were so semi-socialistic and certainly small-d democratic, rose up after the Civil War and formed the Populist Party. They demanded public ownership of the banks, the railroads, the steamships, the communication systems, and equal rights for women, the referendum, the recall, a lot of really great stuff. And they were leftists. And people on the right, even though they may be working class, are not populist. They're fascists. And Le Pen, fascism has a very clear definition. It's a corporate ownership of the state. That's what Mussolini said it was, and that's who Marine Le Pen and Donald Trump are. They're fascists, and they're not populists of the right. It's a contradiction in terms. There's no such thing as a populist on the right. So now let's get down to it. I think the idea if the government shuts down, God forbid, but if it shuts down and Trump makes the operation of the government, holds it hostage to his changing the health care, then I think we actually have a chance to get rid of him. I think the combination of having broken the law, which he's clearly done in many different ways, having brought us to the brink of nuclear war, being clearly incompetent, and now shutting the government, they all are very reminiscent of Richard Nixon. You know, he was not impeached, and he was brought down by a popular movement. It was the anti-war movement that prevented Richard Nixon from using nuclear weapons in Vietnam, which he told Daniel Ellsberg he wanted to do but wouldn't do it because of the anti-war movement. So we're in a similar situation today. And I think that if the government shuts, then we need to find the right thing to boycott, and we need to think about that. I don't know what it is exactly at this point in time. We don't have a salt dependent. Maybe we should boycott sugar. Try that one. We do have the power at the grassroots, I think, to force this president out. Now, it's an existential moment because we wind up with Mike Pence, but at least we'll accomplish stage one. So what I want to do now with Mimi Kennedy and John Kennedy, John Simon, we actually, as usual, are running out of time. I want to talk about the Montana primary. We saw in Atlanta, as far as I'm concerned, I think both of you, clear manipulation of the electronic vote count. We maybe not quite so clear in Kansas, but we know that there's been massive elimination of people through cross-check, which Greg Palast has unearthed, and all sorts of hanky-panky. But what kind, Mimi, what is the voting situation in Montana, and what kind of chance is there that the Democrats could actually stumble into a victory?
Well, it's a paper ballot state. This is according to the verifier. And I'm looking at legislation to know about audits, post-election audits. In other words, everybody's voting on a paper ballot in Montana. That is 50% of the problem right there. And it said that a minimum of 5% of precincts in each county needs to be manually audited. And that's from 2009. It's a conduct of a random sample audit. And the random sample audit must be completed at least one day before the official canvass, I guess, by the County Board of Canvassers, I guess, is completed. Sometimes the language of these is hard, but in other words, they have an audit law and they have paper ballots. These aspects of Montana's election, especially when it's narrowed down to, when is the election? It's a special election, correct?
Yes, I think it's in a couple of weeks. John,
okay.
Do you have to know? And the
question on the ballot is a primary for one congressional district, correct?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, so it's not a lot, not a big ballot. There's one question on a paper ballot to decide. I'm sure they always throw in something else generally. I don't know where the district is, but I'm looking at the state. It's all paper ballot, no matter what county it is, and there is a manual statewide audit requirement, so no matter what county it is. Other than that, I'm not in front of which district it is, but what I would do with my research to really know the chances of a good election are look at the special election, look at the district, and then compare the district to how many counties. You'll be you'll be horrified to know the Wichita, Kansas counties involved in the election, a mix of, I believe, 17 counties. Many of them were all DRE. Some of them were paper ballot, and some were a mix of paperless, direct record electronic, paperless, no paper, and paper ballot. That would probably be the absentee paper ballot in those counties. But 17 county officials, 17 county structures had a say in that special election in Wichita. So good luck, because any single one of them adding something in my book to the mass of votes could possibly infect something on the Secretary of State's website. I don't know. I don't want to make accusations, but really that's the kind of trouble we're in. You think one district, it's just going to be one question on the ballot and one central tabulator tabulating these ballots. No, not necessarily. These gerrymandered districts often chop up all kinds of counties, and in Wichita, Kansas, it was 17 of them.
Yeah, let me jump in on that, because the Montana election, it's statewide. So, you know, in a sense, that simplifies things. You got all the counties. The problem with Montana is that, you know, the polls, and I think there was just a recent one today, it's showing the Democratic candidate, you know, well behind. I think the one today was 15 points behind. So you're not looking at expectations of a Democratic victory. It just becomes a question of what his showing is. Candidate's name is Quist. So, you know, it's a hard one to go on. I mean, the Georgia one strikes us, I think, as being, in a sense, you know, if anything, more actionable, although since it was all on DREs, there's no other than impounding the machines, there's nothing that could have been done by way of recount. But, you know, in that situation, Ossoff was actually ahead. And again, you know, you make a very good point that that Ossoff was the Democrat, and he was ahead. When I say ahead, he was above 50%. So he was on pace to win outright before he got knocked down to, I think, 48.3% or 48.6%. So, again, very narrow margin, after a glitch, very late in the game. The real point here is that, you know, these are single contest ballots. You got one contest on the ballot between two candidates. If anything was ever hand countable, this would be it. And, you know, I've been trying to get in touch with Ossoff and his campaign because, you know, literally every hour I get a crying request for more money, you know, so they can match the Republicans on this runoff that they're having in June. And that's all they want is, you know, more money and more money. And I'm saying, look, you know, make a stand. Say, you know, you are going to withdraw from this race unless this race is counted observably in public by hand. It's one race. They could be done by 10 p.m. We're not talking about a ballot with, you know, 30 propositions on it and 15 different elections. It's one race. Do you want, you know, this candidate A or candidate B, period, end of story. It could be hand-counted. You know, that's a situation where a candidate who has already made national waves and made the national news and lost, you know, under 50% by a whisker and has the interests of both parties could make a stand. No response.
You're 100% right. You're 100% right.
Yeah. And Georgia has been bad for a long time. I don't know if you read the article I put out about it, but I was saying, you know, it might be good to go get a paper ballot if you want to make sure that your vote could be verified later on, at least anonymously, to have it on paper. So you, there is no reason, is a legitimate reason to ask for an absentee ballot, according to Georgia Election Code. Well, then I went online to see if I could, if I were a voter, request a paper ballot. There's only a, there's a checklist of all the other reasons that you might be asking for your absentee ballot. No reason does not appear on that checklist. So you'd have to lie and check something else if you wanted to print out your paper ballot online and be able to send it in as an absentee voter. Otherwise, you can go, it said, and request one at a county office. During the early voting period, you can go and request an absentee ballot. Well, during the early voting period, you can request your absentee ballot, and you will be directed to a DRE. And they'll go, no, vote right here, right now. This is, can be, instead of your absentee ballot, we're not going to give you that. But we're giving you, since you're here, a chance to vote right now instead of on election day. Please use this DRE.
Yeah, Georgia is really, as you say, ugly, and there are a bunch of other states that are ugly. Wisconsin is ugly. There are quite a few ugly states, most of them controlled by Republicans at the administrative and legislative level, some by Democrats. You know, it's ugly. But again, you know, you could request absentee ballots or even get absentee ballots till you're blue in the face, as long as they're counting, you know, 5% of the vote or 10% or 20% or let alone 80 or 90% by DREs. What difference does it make? So your ballot gets counted. Counted, but they rigged these other machines and determine the electoral result. I mean, that's why I'm saying it is the whole system. I mean, all these various quirks smell, but the whole system is absolutely putrid. It's designed for concealment rather than transparency. It's designed for concealment. Now, you got John Ossoff, who's running in Georgia 6, who got, you know, 48.3% of the vote, whether that was legitimately under 50% or rigged under 50%, we will never know. But he is in a position, with the national attention that that race has drawn, to say, look, I'm not running in a race where there is no observability, no verifiability, no recountability, no nothing of the votes. This is a charade. So we either agree that we're going to count these votes by hand, or I'm withdrawing from this race. All right, so he doesn't win. He's not going to win anyway. We know that. Yeah. Harvey, I mean, we've slammed you for saying we know that, but we know that pretty much. I mean, we can look at patterns, and we know he's not going to win. I mean, let's put it this way. If he wins, you know, we'll all sit down and eat our computers with a knife and fork, you know? So
right.
We know that. So really, as Trump would say, what has he got to lose? To make a stand, actually make a name for himself outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And this is where, the frustration comes in, because we cannot get through past the gatekeepers. We cannot prevail upon even a candidate like Elizabeth Warren or somebody that seems to have principle, a John Ossoff, young, progressive, maverick, you know, to make this stand and bring this issue out into the public. And frankly, we don't know why.
Well, Deborah Bowen did, as the Secretary of State of California. And I'll tell you what happened to her. She was shamed and blamed, and her vulnerabilities were mined to the dregs.
And Kevin Shelley, too, for that matter, before Barbara Bowen. I mean, they were both, you know, basically run out of town on a rail. And that is true.
there's your disincentive. But in terms of what I wish would happen with somebody, you know, when I see Schumer's face and Pelosi's face, I wish they would realize what that meant to new voters, the so-called independent and nonpartisan voter. It's just somebody who's been around too long. You just don't trust them. And I think they've done some good things. They've also done some things I hated, like impeachment is off the table when George W. Bush lied us into war. Nonetheless, why isn't the Democratic Party, this is what I ask myself, capable of producing leadership that withdraws and says it's not all up to me? I can actually step back and nothing will fall apart. And so, in fact, I might be able to create the space for something better to happen. And I give myself as a mentor so that it can. Well, of course, they don't, because their donors want them in place. And it's the money that is stopping this whole thing. But money cannot stop smaller jurisdictions from coming to their senses and voters having wins in those jurisdictions. That's the only thing I keep saying. It's whack-a-mole, because the ballot box is controlled at such a small level. The media is national. The donors are controlling everything nationally, and they do filter down to small areas. Greg Palast's movie said that very beautifully about how Chris Kobach's money filtered all the way down to counties in Texas to do what he wanted, and media outlets. But nonetheless, I keep thinking that this struggle is on the ground, county by county, and people are waking up. But as far as the National Democratic Party, they have been absolutely AWOL.
Absolutely, and they're horrible. They're more than AWOL. They're against us.
Although Hank Johnson of Georgia has a bill that would mandate a paper ballot nationally. And, of course, it can't go anywhere in a Republican Congress, but he's introduced it last Congress, and we'll do it again this Congress.
Hey, thank you guys so much. New York. See you next week.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks, Harvey.
Thanks, guys.
Solar Utopia, Solar Utopia, Solar Utopia.